This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 24th of January 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 342 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Mr. Robert Bound.
On the show today, we'll be hearing from film producer John Smithson, one of the creative forces behind new documentary Sherpa, which tells the stories of those living and working on Mount Everest.
We'll also be meeting Aisha Malik, the author whose debut novel, Sophia Khan Is Not Obliged, is hoping to use a little comedy and romance to change perceptions of what it means to be young, single and Muslim in London.
And we'll meet Joseph Selig, the arts and festival director who's bringing the London International Mime Festival to the city this month. And of course, we won't be miming on the radio.
That's all coming up. Plus Monocle's Tom Edwards will be here with the news look ahead. And we'll play some good music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
I loved your gusto in the menu there, Andrew. You really said it like you mean it. Once more with feeling, they said, and Andrew delivered on all fronts. Have you had a nice week?
I've had a very nice week. Well, I was being tickled under the table because for some reason, Mr. Tom Edwards, who's going to join us later, was underneath the desk.
He's here already.
We'll ask him. I think he had got his wires tangled with his chair leg. Unless he's trying to hide and play peekaboo. I don't think that's going to work. I've had a good week. It's, you know, we were back on the horse anyway after New Year, but this week was like full gallop.
Full gallop, exactly. My favourite part of the week was a nice luncheon with our mutual friend and former Monocle Weekly guest, at least once, Peter Mead.
Yes.
Founder of Abbott Mead, yeah. Vickers Advertising Agency. What a great man he is. Had a little we toasted the new year.
He told us many funny stories, none of which I think can be repeated on
really?
Air.
Can I say
that? No. Okay. You can't tell any of those stories. They were hush-hush. I think it would ruin his reputation. We should say that on the slogan for the show. Come on the show. We might take you out for lunch later. That's it. Mr.
Yeah,
Peter Mead.
Exactly.
We liked him.
So it's all good. I'm looking forward to trotting our guests into the studio.
Good. So we have an impressive lineup.
Don't say it like that, like you're reading it off a page of paper.
No, we do have an impressive lineup.
We have an impressive lineup, it says here. First things first, though, shall we
get the old nag in? Get the old nag in first.
Yeah.
Who's that moving at the speed of light? Darting around the globe with his golden cape aflutter, waggling his chunky glasses, and giving us a knowing wink as he passes. His cuddly beauty silhouetted against the stars. Who could have such a wise yet pretty face? Or such a wiggly bottom? Could it be? Oh, yes, it's Monocle's very own Clark Kent, our intrepid reporter and all-round lifesaver. And look, he's coming into land. Please welcome the one and only Super Tedwards, the news bear who likes his stories served with ice cream, please. We love you, Super Tedwards.
Hi, Tom.
What were you doing under the table?
Because I heard there was a sort of an equine theme, so I was channeling my inner Shetland pony and getting down low. I'm not a pair of thoroughbreds like you two.
How many hands are you? About two?
Yeah, modest. Little tiny hands as well. That doesn't really work on radio, but go with it.
A joke about the measurement system used for horses there.
Yeah.
First up, in the first 5 minutes of the Monocle
Weekly.
We
take care of our, you know, agricultural and rural listeners as well.
Equine listeners.
Equine fanciers.
Yeah. Naysayers.
Hey!
Carry on.
Okay, well, trot on, mate. What have you got on the news look ahead?
Well, I thought first up we'd just quickly mark our listeners' cards to some of the delights ahead on Monocle 24. Mm. Where are various Monocle 24 and Monocle contributors gallivanting off to this week? One I know you guys probably want to talk about, one of my favourite trade shows.
What is
Boot.
Boot?
The big boat.
A German boat
it's
show.
It's the only place to go if you're interested in boats. And Captain Alaguer is... been dispatched. So we'll be hearing from him during the week. From there, all aboard.
Yeah.
From so there.
He's going to be looking after all of our...
Where is Boot?
Dusseldorf. Yeah. Not necessarily the first place you think of in maritime terms.
We might have it in Hamburg, possibly, but no, they have it in Dusseldorf.
They know a thing or two.
So they're all shipped in. Yeah. I mean, to use a, that's not pun not, not intended.
Yeah.
Okay. And we chose Matt because he's got such big feet. His shoes are like tugboats. So he's going to be pulled across the channel when by
wearing,
his shoes.
I've never seen him wear trainers, but apparently he doesn't wear trainers because his feet are so big. They look like yachts. It looks like someone's parked two quite decent gin palaces under his desk.
Massive plates. Yeah, everything shipshape with Captain Alagoya.
Have any cobblers been known to turn up to this thing trying to sell their boots and have done it wrong?
I believe that's happened.
Yeah.
All sorts of...
Okay, who else is going? It's quite nice to do the
yeah, Daniel Giacopelli, our good friend, sometimes in this chair,
yeah.
Doing a news look ahead. He's not...
Where will he be strutting around?
He's off to Bavaria.
Okay.
He's going to a sports and outdoor goods, the singular... sports and outdoor goods event
ISPO
in Munich. Who knows? He's going to be coming back with reports of all sorts of, you know, probably thermals. Maybe he'll be coming up with some new thermals.
I love a fleece. I mean,
that's... What about the Long John?
I love a Long John.
There's been time for those in
London
recently.
I've been known to, exactly. Sport a Long John. I like to do some lunges in my Long Johns. That's really the best use for them.
God, that's... Summoned an absolutely
terrifying
picture.
Yeah, that's the whole point.
It's like a meeting with our travel and personnel department.
Come on, it's much more fun than that. How about this one? Where's our Henry Rhys Sheridan going? Spielwarenmesse.
Spielwarenmesse. What's that?
It's the only international toy show you need to know about.
Oh, that I really. These are much better than us sitting in the office. Why are we not going to? This is fun. We should be doing this.
But maybe the weekly should have been at the toy fair.
Oh, man.
On board
a
little. What are they called? Toy train.
Toy train.
Choo choo.
We've got to churn out an issue of Monocle. That's far less fun.
Okay, let's race through. Should we race through some actual substance
news. Okay.
So, we always on election watch. Portugal presidential elections today, Haitian presidential runoffs. Don't ask me the details.
Okay.
I'm just letting you know that's what's coming up. I tell you one place we do like to look, don't we, at Monocle, is to the Arctic, to the frozen north.
Send Steve there.
I know. He always makes his way back.
Yeah, I know.
good snowshoes he's got. The Arctic
frontiers. One way ticket to Svalbard.
Andrew even sent him to North Korea once. He still came back.
You just pop him in a Husky. Off you go, mate.
The Arctic Frontiers Conference in Tromsø, Norway.
Yeah,
issues up for discussion.
It's quite nice. It's quite a nice town, that.
Well, and particularly talking about sustainability, I think, which is a very big play in the region, which is of course being explored for resource exploitation, tourism, all these things changing the face of the region. A couple of other things to mention: it's Burns Night tomorrow. Lots of haggis being consumed, left, right and centre.
You get your haggis out, Andrew?
I think I may pop my haggis out, yeah.
Now, we were at the top of the world, talking about the Arctic. What about heading down under? You know what's Tuesday? Australia Day. That's a nice event.
That is nice.
Oh, we're going to be lucky to get
nothing's going to get done this week. Okay.
Going right back to, you know, marking... We were talking about 1788, first fleet of ships. All the convicts were on board, a few officers and marines as well. All sorts going on. Big fireworks display. Ferry races apparently take place in Sydney Harbour. I've never seen those.
Well, and also, next month we're doing a whole issue.
I thought you might want to mention this, Andrew.
Our March issue is purely about Australia.
Is this the right time to mention that it's going to be in... As Richard Spencer Powell, our creative director, his first idea was to simply print it all upside down.
I know, he's pushing his luck there, isn't he?
I don't know, I think I describe that as visionary.
I think that is visionary.
Is that why he's been wearing that corked hat all week?
I don't know where we can go from that.
I don't think there's anywhere to go. We've been on the top of the world, we've been down under.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for coming in to see us. Ever since Everest was first conquered back in 1953, tales of intrepid climbers making the ascent have captured the public's imagination. But less celebrated are the teams of local mountain experts who accompany every trip, the Sherpas. In 2014, filmmaker Jennifer Peedham aimed to document the role of the Sherpas on Everest, but her time there coincided with the worst tragedy in the history of the mountain when, at 6:45 a.m. on the 18th of April 2014, a 14 million tonne block of ice slid into the path of climbers, killing 16 people.
Her resulting documentary, Sherpa, tells the story of the people who call Everest home and their reaction to an event that changed the global perception of mountaineering in the Himalayas. Myers. The film was produced by Oscar-nominated, now BAFTA-nominated, producer John Smithson, along with fellow filmmaker Bridget Aitken. And Smithson is no stranger to making films among the elements. He produced celebrated 2003 mountaineering documentary Touching the Void and 127 Hours, the film that told the story of hiker Aaron Rolston in the Utah desert, starring James Franco. He joins us now to tell us about how to bring the great outdoors to the big screen. But first, let's hear a clip from Sherpa.
We Sherpa people have a great respect for that mountain. She's the mother god of the earth.
Over here, we climb mountains, but it's a holy place. Western people approach it as a physical challenge to see how close you can get to death.
Every time I send the Sherpas up in the mountain, it's like sending them off to war. I don't know who's going to come home.
John, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
And we mentioned a couple of your other sort of greatest hits there in the introduction. How come this film stayed a documentary rather than being featured, rather than being dramatized?
It's really interesting. You come across these great stories, and that's ultimately what I'm about, finding a great close-up story that illustrates a much bigger point. And so you come across them, like the case of Joe Simpson, an amazing story of survival, falling into that crevasse after the rope was cut, and that remarkable escaping from the crevasse. You find these stories, or Aaron Rolston, the guy who had to cut his arm off to escape the rock in the canyon that he'd been trapped in. You find these stories, and then you sort of look, what is the best way to tell them? Some stories are naturally better told as pure documentary, and often it's easier to do that if the people are still alive and there's archive. Sometimes they're better to be told as scripted drama. What enables you to maximize the power of the story to take the viewer, the audience in a cinema or on the TV screen, right into the heart of that story? And you almost make a judgment call each time. With Touching the Void, we knew we had to do it as a documentary because the real Joe and the real Simon were alive. So the film was put together essentially with their interviews and reenactment to cover their story. In the case of this film just now, Sherpa, it's a real documentary. We were on the mountain to follow re-events. No drama could ever capture what happened to our team on Everest in April of 2014. So it's just, you go where the story leads you.
The truth's better than fiction.
And truth is better than fiction, exactly. Yeah. That's why documentaries are so compelling.
We should just give listeners a tiny, if they haven't seen the film or they don't know much about it, a tiny bit of a snapshot. So it's obviously this huge block of ice comes down, killing many Sherpas. And then it's the consequences of that for the Sherpa community, the relationships between the mountaineers and the Sherpas. You retell some of the context of the Sherpas' lives going back right to the 50s, to that first ascent of Everest. Now, what I found most intriguing was many of the films that you've done, in a way, they look at the heroic side of climbing, the bravery, these people pushing themselves to the edges. And even in this film, one of the characters says, you know, climbing Everest is as close as you're pushing yourself as close as you can to death, and then you hope to return. But what unfolds from this story and the terrible tragedy, by the end of the film, I was left with a sense that the European climbers, the Western climbers who go to Everest, are far from heroes, and the way that they speak about the Sherpas and their reaction after the death of all these people, they're just their gung-ho desire to carry on, that this is really inconsequential. It left me with, you know, a sense of absolute anger at these people, their lack of sensitivity, their kind of stupidity in a way. Has this film changed your view of that climbing community? And has the climbing community's view of you changed a little bit after they've seen this film?
You put your finger on the key issue, because really the whole intention of this film was to tell the story of Everest from the Sherpas' point of view. It's their mountain. It has religious, spiritual, cultural, economic significance to them. We go there, we almost treat it like the ultimate adventure theme park. You know, the tallest place, the highest mountain in the world. There's nowhere else where you can go. All other mountains you climb yourself. You know, you go with a guide and so on. On Everest, the Sherpas provide this brilliant first class, almost like service industry. They put ropes all the way to the top. They take the oxygen up, the food, the camps. So a averagely fit human being who is acclimatized may well make it to the summit. They provided that amazing surface as a service, and it is that ultimate adventure experience. But almost that somehow creates this service industry idea that you were talking about in your question, that almost, because that's what they're doing, but these are accomplished climbers. Perber, the key character in our film, was about to summit Everest, I think, for his 23rd time,
yeah.
A world record. These are totally accomplished climbers. They're not just room service guys or the guy that makes your beds, like the one who...
Butlers in fleeces.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they we've done a lot of question and answer sessions and screenings of this film as it's been going around the world. A lot of, often, mountaineers come, and some of them are actually embarrassed and say, you know, we are right to think of it this way. You've made us think slightly more. We're taking it for granted. But there's something about this summit fever that you pay all your money to go to Everest. You've been training about it for 2 years. You know there's a chance you might not come back alive. You're absolutely focused, come what may, on getting to the top. And you've seen that. We've seen that before with Everest. We've seen that with some of the great stories of Everest, the whole into thin air story of that big disaster, whenever it was, 10, 15 years ago. And there's something about that that arguably blots out all other feelings, because you just get to the top and you use the people that help you to get there, but they're real people too.
There are some numbers. There were three numbers that popped up in the film that kind of stuck in mind. The climbing industry for Nepal is worth $360 million to the country, that people climbing Everest are paying up to $75,000 each to climb up. And then when these families, you know, lose the leader of their family in this terrible tragedy, they're offered $400. That is, and what's interesting is there's, this gentleman, Russell Bryce, who appears again and again, and, he's one of these people who's just about the mountain. You know, he begins one of those sentences with, of course, we're upset about people dying, but we need to carry on. And he accuses them of being hotheads when they are upset about walking over the bodies of the dead. You think, what is going on here? This is, do you think there was something will change from this film that it will have the power to kind of shake people? Because I got to that end of the film and I was like, I was properly angry at the whole process. It just seemed so skew-whiff and so against the Sherpas.
I mean, because of this terrible disaster, what that did is give us an opportunity as the storytellers, as the filmmakers. It blew everything up into sharp relief, this simmering tension beneath the surface between the Sherpas and the Westerners. So all the issues you just mentioned there, the money the Westerners pay to climb the mountain, everything came out in the wash. And some of those bigger, heavier points that we were talking about a few moments ago, we knew they could all come out. It's just like in that cloud of anger, emotion, which morphed into resentment, and then ultimately the Sherpas taking matters into their own hand and seizing control of the mountain. We knew we had an incredibly rich scene.
But just a tiny thing, there were some stories at the time, but without you there, this story would have gone away by now. Now, this has this has longevity. This is a kind of a conscience piece that you haven't done it as a conscience piece. But this must kind of, as you say, if you're a mountaineer and you're heading to Everest, surely this must provoke you to think about how you behave and what you do on that mountain.
And there's lots of evidence that I wouldn't. It would be arrogant to claim it's just our film, but one of the best ways change can happen is if the people spending all their money, all their life savings or whatever, a lot of rich people go as well, not life savings, to go to Everest. If they are aware of the issues, that's good, because that starts people asking for better conditions. It's just like fashion, when people want to know a garment's not been made by a little kid in Bangladesh being paid $1 a week. You want to know that those, in the case of Everest, those carrying the risk are properly rewarded. It gets massively complex because obviously a successful Sherpa in a good season earns around $5,000. Now, that's good money in Nepal, which is a poor country. So it's not like they should suddenly get... I don't think anyone's arguing they should suddenly get $100,000 or pounds or whatever. But what is absolutely the case are there some things that the film threw up which do seem to be scandalous, like the tiny amount of compensation that they get in the event that their families get in the event they die. And I think there is an awareness now by climbers who are going there. I mean, there was a review I saw by John Krakauer, the eminent writer who wrote the brilliant Into Thin Air, saying everyone ever thinking of climbing Everest, something like this, he said, anyone who's ever thinking of climbing Everest should watch this film so they can understand and then act on their own conscience. That doesn't mean you don't use Sherpas. On the contrary, I think it's incredibly valuable to do that, but you might cause you to interrogate the people that you are you're paying your money to about how much, what the conditions are for the Sherpas. And in defence of Russell, who comes across in a complex way in the film, Russell Price, the most experienced of all the operators on Everest, he does look after his Sherpas very well and cares profoundly about safety. But we show Russell we show him in all his complexity on the film.
I agree with you, but there's that one bit at the end where he's like talking to them in the tent, and he, you know, It harks back to the bit where you've got, you know, looking at the Sherpa tenting back in the 50s. There's one bit where he's looking at the tent and he says, you know, I'm worried for you. We like you as like the smiley Sherpas. And you think, this is almost colonial. This is like, you know, can't you all just be smiley again? You know, they have lost, you know, 16 people have been killed and they're being asked to kind of buck up their ideas and start smiling again. And there's, he is a complex character and he obviously does care and he's passionate about the mountain. But as an outsider, you feel very isolated from him as a person in that moment, I think.
I mean, I'm glad you're talking like that, because what we did deliberately with the film is this disaster created an opportunity, a storytelling opportunity, to lay out, following the events in the aftermath of this terrible disaster, all these issues absolutely in sharp relief, all out there, had to be sorted with. And we told it as it was, and didn't choose to put a polemic commentary on it, saying, how scandalous is this, or whatever. Let you, the viewer of the film, decide. We assume the audience going to see this film is going to be an intelligence audience. We thought it was our job. Let's lay out the issues and let people decide. And I'm encouraged by what you're saying, and lots of people who've seen the film and come to Q&As that we do about it. It makes them think. And a lot of people didn't even know that the Sherpas were a people. They thought Sherpa was just a word for a porter.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a culture, a proud culture. You know, and we are so framed by those images of Sherpa tenting in 1953.
Whether that itself, you know, framed in the black and white, and the, you know, it was still a time of empire. You know, Edmund became Sir Edmund, and Sherpa Tenzing got a George Cross,
some inferior form of award,
second class honour.
Yeah,
it's tough, isn't it?
It's, you know, someone, we did a BAFTA screening last night, and someone said this is the most fascinating film about an industrial dispute I've ever seen.
Yeah,
that's not something you'd put on the poster, right, is it? You're not going to rush to your multiplex to see the most fascinating film about. But in a way, it is, because it was about a fundamental clash between those that pay for the service and those that have to perform the service. But I say, it's just not a quote I would use often, but it has a glimmer of more than a glimmer of truth
and
to it.
Beyond film, are you a man who's drawn to the mountains? Why is the mountain and mountaineers so important to you?
I'm not a mountaineer. I've been in mountains and do a bit of skiing, but I don't particularly like heights, which is not very helpful if you want to go in the mountains. But I like stories, and there's something about people at the extremes of their mental and physical state that is a rich story seam. So that incredible story in Touching the Void of Joe Simpson's Will to Survive, that incredible story of Aaron Ralston knowing he had to cut off his own arm in order to save his life. There's something at the absolute extremes that is so fascinating about the human condition that makes an incredibly rich scene. And I think it's great if you're in the visual, if you're in a visual medium, if you're in film and television, it's so powerful to hear it and to see it. And I think often it's more powerful than to read it. And that's why I'm drawn to them. But I'm drawn to individuals in those, and I'm drawn to amazing survival stories. I'm drawn to people caught up in disasters and how that influences them. I'm not a ghoul, I'm not an ambulance chaser, but I am fascinated when these things occur. It's no coincidence I've made 9 or 10 films about 9/11 because that was the biggest story that's maybe happened in my lifetime. And the idea of 3,000-4,000 people, ordinary people, caught up in the events of that building and how they all reacted, I think is something that's universal for all of us and I think is a legitimate area to make films about. And I have done that on a number of films which, you know, have been very well received and award-winning on that very subject. So it's more, it's all about the story, and mountains is a particularly rich, a rich source of stories because of what they are.
Well, John Smithson, thank you so much for talking us through Sherpa and other things. Sherpa is nominated for Best Documentary BAFTA. It's currently in cinemas and will be broadcast globally on Discovery in 2016.
Time for some new music. This is the beautifully contemplative new number from Vampire Weekend's Rostam Batmangli, going under the singular moniker of Rostam. This is EOS.
Listen to the crickets in my heart. Can you hear that sound? Dusk in the tangles out your feelings, and everyone else's first to let go down. Everyone else's first to let me down. Everyone else's first to let on our own.
That was Rostam with EOS. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Books about romance, dating and making any kind of relationship work in the fractured bustle of city life are nothing new. And the phenomenal success of series ranging from Bridget Jones to 50 Shades of Grey show female-fronted fiction is a genre that speaks to a huge readership, namely women. And that success shouldn't be the exception to the rule in an often sadly male-dominated world.
Aisha Malik is an author hoping that her debut novel, Sophia Khan Is Not Obliged, might help to break down a few more barriers. It's the story of the titular central character navigating dating in London. But what makes the book more unusual is that its protagonist, a 30-year-old publisher, is Muslim. A little earlier, Aisha joined Rob to tell him how the subtleties of British Muslim culture have influenced her writing, why that topic hasn't been successfully brought into the mainstream before, and why she's hoping to change all of the above.
Congratulations on the book. It's a handsome debut novel. It's just out in paperback. That's obviously a presumably a great feeling. When did it become apparent to you, as someone that works in publishing itself, that this was going to be the debut, that actually the things that were perhaps happening to you, or certainly happening to the character in your head, would take this form?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer, and I'd tried and failed a few times at writing a literary fiction piece. And in many ways, Bridget Jones has kind of been a part of every British woman's life and non-British woman's life as well for 10, 15 years. And so she has kind of been an inspiration to certainly my generation. But she's also now quite dated as a female character because, you know, she's quite hapless and she doesn't have what we would call like a feisty nature. And I wanted to create a character who had elements of the Bridget about her, but who was also different and contemporary and, of course, Muslim.
So there's an element of sort of being every woman, but also an element of being a specific Muslim every woman.
Yes.
And that's the every woman that people don't know and that needs to be not explained, but it needs to be made light of as much as can be, which is maybe if your book has a job, then maybe that's its job.
That's certainly its job. I think with all the negative media portrayal that Muslims get, I find it sad and frustrating that there's not another angle to what being a Muslim is living in London. And I really wanted to just portray the normality of living as a British Muslim and how most of our day-to-day is made up of trying to find prayer space in the office or, you know, getting caught with your foot in the sink because you're making ablutions to pray, you know? Those kind of comic moments, which, you know, I think would be fun to explore in literature.
Yeah. I think, I don't know whether I'm getting your Twitter feed confused with Sophia in the book.
Some people have said the voices are slightly interchangeable.
But there was a nice moment when the character, in any case, is offered her boss's office to pray in while he's just out at a meeting, and how refreshing that is.
Yes, my agent, that happened today actually. My agent said, yeah, that's okay. Fine, go pray in my office. I'm just going to nip it off and see a client. It's like, great, thank you.
So there's an element there of making this stuff the normality, that these things are as stupid as Bridget Jones tucking her skirt into her knickers. I mean, this is the same sort of...
Yeah, exactly.
This comes from the same place, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just a Muslim angle.
And a lot of the book is... Well, not a lot of the book, but I suppose there is running through it the skein that is the idea of dating, especially. Mm-hmm. This is a thing. Were there any bits you had to, not for personal reasons, leave out, but leave out to stop any sort of outrage? I wonder whether there is a polishing of rough edges.
I don't think I needed to leave anything out. I think I had to pay attention to certain sensitivities given the global climate to do with, you know, making too much light of things like terrorism, because obviously it's such a heavy issue. So I had to think a lot about both cultural sensitivities, both in my own community and or would be a wider readership, because I didn't want to make light of issues, but I did want to portray certain issues and, you know, in a way where we can look at them and kind of ridicule them, you know, and think how silly they are. And by making light of it, hopefully, you know, bringing about a bit more understanding.
Because that's the thing. I mean, the idea of mother-in-law jokes presumably have been going for sort of 5,000 years.
Yeah.
and there are those in here as well.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things that I suppose you want people, wherever they are in the world, whatever religion or none they're from, to be able to look at this and find leitmotifs that apply to people, whether they're Muslim, whether they're Christian, whatever they might
be. Yeah, absolutely.
That we all kind of live in the great sort of washing machine tumble dryer of life, mm-hmm. and these things, and a lot of socks go pink in the wash.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah.
And tell me about the writing of the novel. I mean, you're obviously a full-time job at a publishing company. The book is in various different formats. You know, we mentioned the diary format and all the rest of it. But did that help the writing, the sort of weekends and evenings style?
I've always enjoyed the diary format. In fact, when I did my master's in creative writing, the first piece of fiction that I wrote was in diary format. It also has that same kind of Bridget Jones structure, which I find quite easy to follow. And the blogging and the text messaging and email, that's just part of modern living. It was, you know, it was very natural to write in that form with the way we live and
on the online dating communication and stuff, which is quite good.
Yeah.
The shadi.com dating website, which is interesting. And I read at the beginning of that chapter, which is kind of, which doesn't it say, you know, you'll find a husband if your complexion is wheatish.
Yes.
So the lighter you are, and when we maybe you can fill us in on this.
It's a play on kind of the hypocrisy, I suppose, in the South Asian culture, where on one hand, you know, Western white people are seen as the other in older generations, and yet at the same time they're kind of scrambling to be white. So it's just another ridiculous cultural notion which deserves to be made fun of.
And there's a lot of this in the book, the fact that actually no one gets it right. I mean, there's this stuff which is kind of funny, that's saying, yes, you've got to marry, you've got to, you know, you shouldn't be white, but you should look a bit whiter if you want to get married to someone.
Yes, exactly.
There's
that
part. And then there's serious stuff where the character in the book, Sophia, is, you know, called a terrorist, mm-hmm. and she follows this man, the man with the briefcase, with the brown briefcase and all the rest of it, and actually bumps into a little old lady on the tube train who says, oh, you know, know, my you must be hot in that headscarf.
Yes, yeah.
And the rest of it. Are these things that have happened to you?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain things that I've gleaned from my own experiences. I was once called a terrorist, and I have, you know, faced some kind of racial abuse on the tube before. And, you know, I've also met wonderful people who have, you know, a broader view of things. And I wanted to bring that all because it's so much a part of living in London. And I just wanted that to kind of come to the surface.
One of the things that will happen, I guess, especially if your book is a great success, is that people, it will be taken to mean more than just the life of a 30-something Muslim woman trying to find a husband or wanting mm-hmm. to find a husband in London. What does that feel like? I mean, because there's an element of inviting that with the publication of it and wanting that, but there's quite a lot of, not heaviosity, but I guess there's some responsibility there that might be tricky. You can say, well, I'm just writing about a single 30-something woman in London, but there is, I guess, it becomes freighted in the time in which we live or the time in which people say some of the things in which we live.
Yeah, it's
what do you think about the world's longest question?
Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to think how to answer it. I think first and foremost, I see myself as a writer without specifically a single agenda. I've always wanted to write, so that's what I'm doing. These kind of Muslim issues naturally come to the fore because I wear a scarf and because we are so so much in the media. I don't know how it will play out and I don't know how it will go, but I like writing about these. The book is not an issue book, but I like threading in these issues into a wider narrative because I think it helps people, a wider readership, engage with the issues without kind of drumming it into them. And I think comedy is a great way to do that without kind of writing a serious literary fiction book about how dire it is to be, you know, a Muslim and trying to practice your religion in London, because it's just, it's A, not true, and B, I think, just a bit stuffy.
Yeah. And what are the things that people get wrong, people in Sophia's office life in the novel, and maybe that are similar to the things that have happened to you? What do non-Muslims frequently get wrong, maybe even out of over politeness rather than racism?
I don't know if it's getting things wrong, so to speak. It's just being unaware of a whole new way of living. And the publishing industry is actually incredibly polite. So where I worked for a few years, it was lovely because no one flinched at me, you know, needing to pray using the sales conference room or being at an author's launch party and using his living room as prayer space. It's not so much what they get wrong as the kind of just the foreignness of the practice. But I can't really say that I've had problems in that area, maybe because I'm just so open about, you know, what I have to do.
And I just wanted to go back to that question of a novel, of your novel being freighted with a responsibility that maybe it doesn't, its shoulders weren't designed to bear. Do you have to, when you come and talk to people like us here, do you have to have some answers in the back of your head for some of the questions that people might inevitably shoot you?
Not necessarily, but I do think that what I'm proud of about the book the most is that it's a Muslim protagonist. And I do think that there is a lack of that in literature, Muslim women writing Muslim characters. And I don't mind that weight so much, because I think what's also great about the book is that it's quite commercial, and so it's not, you know, up there with literary fiction, you know, reaching kind of a marginal audience. Rather, it's there to, I don't know what weight it will carry or it won't carry, but I think it's kind of maybe helping to pave the way for hopefully more Muslim writers.
And what I always ask of people when they've written a great book which seems to have such great filmic potential, who's going to play Sophia Khan?
I have no idea who's going to play Sophia Khan, but I do think that if Jake Gyllenhaal was available for Connell, then that would be great.
Oh, yeah, Connell's good
and
as well,
then maybe,
isn't he?
Maybe I could play Sophia Khan.
There we are.
So there we have it, yeah.
There we are.
Yeah.
Done.
And
that's a sequel written as well, right away, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Sophia Khan goes on honeymoon.
Yeah.
Why not?
Why not? Yeah.
Aisha Malik, thank you very much for coming and talking us through. Sophia Khan is not obliged.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that was Ayesha Malik talking to Rob a little bit earlier. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
We've pursued some pretty strange ideas on this show, but none more potentially doomed than an item about mime, the dramatic art form that includes no sound at all and relies entirely on visuals on a radio show. But there's plenty to say about mime, and we're very lucky to be joined now by an authority on the topic. Joseph Selig, OBE, is founder and co-director of the London International Mime Festival that brings 24 days of programming, 64 performances and 18 international acts to the city until the 6th of Feb.
And Joseph is no stranger to staging arts events on the grandest of stages, having formerly held positions including International Programme Director of the Hong Kong Arts Festival and Artistic Director of the New Zealand Festival too. And he joins us now to tell us why mime, or rather physical theatre, deserves to be talked up a little bit more. Joseph, welcome to Monocle Weekly. And you corrected us almost before we started. I think we're going to dive straight into this term mime, because I think, you know, everybody falls into the idea of Marcel Marceau and the kind of like the invisible brick wall and et cetera, et cetera. How much of a hindrance is this term mime in narrowing people's expectations, what they think you're going to do?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, it's a bit like your introduction. I don't actually feel doomed, and as the festival has been going for 40 years, I see no reason to change all that. But yes, mime is sort of, it's a funny word. Okay, our title is not only historic, it's sort of probably very misleading, but it's one of those things. The festival, you know, hasn't been broke. Well, I'm not talking financially, but you know what I mean. So we haven't really wanted to fix it by changing the title. So we just use mime as an umbrella word, which means theatre, all sorts of entertainment which doesn't rely on spoken word. And this involves circus, puppetry, live art, clown theatre, all sorts of things. The trouble with the word mime, and I hope we don't need to spend too much time about this, is that people have only one idea about it, if they have one at all. If you say to somebody music, they've usually heard of more than one musician or composer. Nobody says, oh, yeah, music, that's Mozart, isn't it? Or painting or football or anything you care to think of. But mime, well, they've only heard of Marcel Marceau, haven't they? I mean, he was a great artiste, but he became an art form in himself. But there's more to it than that. And, you know, that's it. So our title is historic, but it's the good thing, or the great thing about it, the reason I think that we have survived and flourished, dare I say it, for a long time. And it's very nice to be involved with something that has endured. And sometimes you wonder why that is. And the reason is because something that doesn't rely on language is internationally accessible. You know, we live in a city of, I don't know how many million people, at least half of whom seem to be from somewhere else. So, you know, or whose first language isn't English. So, you know, what could be more attractive?
I wondered when I first read that we were going to be interviewing you, Joseph, about how pitches work for this, actually. But for physical theatre, how long the pitch is to you, for example, whether to put it into your programme, how people sort of set out their stall to you for something which
well,
is wordless.
It's quite a rigorous selection procedure, I suppose. We see everything. We see every production before we invite it to the festival. So somebody's sending us a DVD of highlights or, you know, 5 minutes. It's always just the best 5 minutes or the only 5 minutes that are any good. So, you know, we travel extensively and we only take shows that we've seen and, you know, which we know will be successful, not only for us, but for the artists and for the audience, which are feasible, which are stageable, which are affordable. And ultimately, you know, it is, you know, the taste of myself and my co-director, Helen Lanigan. If nobody who sees a show, which is very unlikely, actually liked it, well, it's there because we did like it and we can justify it. You know, there's no good bringing something which people don't like and then you go, oh, God, we didn't see it, you know. So it's, you know, people, it's not a matter of them doing a pitch. People will talk to us about a project or send us a DVD, and if we think it looks interesting, we'll go and see it.
now surprised a little, because I think the other question about, you know, physical theatre, and you know, I like the idea of it being international and anybody kind of understanding it, but there is a kind of watered down version of that, isn't there? You know, the world of, not being rude about it, but, Cirque du Soleil, Mr. Bean, that kind of slapstick kind of, everybody can laugh at it, but it becomes a little bit kind of bland. Yeah. If you're not careful. How does it become sharper in the kind of things that you're choosing?
Because Cirque du Soleil is an up-and-down entertainment. Mr. Bean, who is, hugely popular everywhere in the world except in this country, is just funny. But, the Mime Festival comprises, 18 or so productions, people telling their stories without using words. But,
and I presume they're not all about humour, either.
Not at all. So very few of them are necessarily comic or funny productions. We opened this year with something which was both, I suppose it was humorous, but it was about ageing. There are shows about, it doesn't sound a barrel of laughs, does it? But, dementia or all sorts of social issues, some of which are, more or less serious. But it isn't just pratfalls and ha ha ha. No, not at all. So, Cirque du Soleil, they hoover up every funny physical act or every clown there is, and Rowan Atkinson, he is a great mime, actually, and he's a great actor, but it's far removed from what we do.
I wonder what the trends and the vogues are in physical theatre at the moment, because I guess you watch these DVDs, you watch the first 5 minutes of these DVDs or the best 5 minutes, and you travel a lot to see these things. But I wonder if there is, for example, a trend of doing wordless Shakespeare in physical theatre, or doing wordless Beckett in physical theatre. Well, there is a lot of physical theatre in Beckett, for example.
Well, actually,
but you know what I mean? I wonder if there are trends like there are in the current theatre with words. Yes.
I mean, actually, you mentioned Beckett. I mean, half his output was physical, wordless. Yeah. Yes. I think, so you asked what are the current trends? I mean, digital, the use of new technologies is very popular. It's not sort of something you find so much here, but in France and in Germany, a lot of work relies on use of technology.
Just on those places, are France and Germany, because they are old-fashioned theatrical places, but often have to make sense of themselves outside of France and Germany, whereas the English language maybe doesn't have to or has a head start. Do you find more physical theatre in those places?
I think the answer is no. I mean,
or more of an appetite for it.
I think people on the continent aren't so bothered about categorising everything. Look, this is the country of Shakespeare. Our festival isn't there to say, we're better than spoken theatre. Not at all. On the contrary, but there is a great deal of, what would you say, sort of snobbery in a way in this country. If there ain't any words, what on earth's it doing? But France has we'll just talk about France, because that is somewhere. There is a long and noble tradition of visual theatre in France. It's not to do with Marcel Marceau. It's nothing to do with that at all. But the French actually invest a lot of money in culture, much more than we do. They invest a lot of money in circus. We invest almost none in circus. The French have, as many other countries do, a ministry of culture. We don't have anything. We've got a Department of
Culture, Media and Sport.
Yeah, that's right. We lump it all because we're a bit sort of, embarrassed about culture, or we think of culture as being, high art, the Royal Opera House and museums and things, we don't think of some of the things that are in our festival or street theatre or, lots of things as being culture. So anyway, all I'm saying is that there is a great deal of government money that goes into the arts in France, into the sort of fields of theatre that we're interested in. So that is a rich hunting ground for us. I mentioned Germany. I think it's probably, it isn't somewhere that's especially rich generally, but, there is a great interest in all sorts of different cultures. And here we're still really,
Are you going to have a go at us?
Well, no, I'm not going to have a go at you at all. No. But listen, the situation in this country is absolutely it's very, very healthy at the moment. You know, in the recent spending review, you know, the Arts Council, everybody thought they were going to sort of lie down and be rolled over, and they weren't. You know, the situation is healthy. But when you look at the amount of money that is spent on the arts in this country, I mean, it's from central government, it is a minute amount of the total. That is, you know, of public money. Everybody thinks it's 100 times more than it is. I think we get a great deal for what is given to us. But I seem to be diverting.
No, but you've run this amazingly since 1977.
Yes.
And has it always happened every single year, and you've managed
no,
to...
No, I think we missed 2 years. I can remember why we missed 1 year, but I can't remember why we missed the other year. But the year which we did miss...
There's a clue.
I think it was because the Arts Council decided that they would alternate funding between our festival and a dance festival. And it just so happened that it was, I don't know, maybe somebody tossed a coin and decided that the next year the money would go to that particular dance festival. So we did our festival in Hong Kong, as it happens.
But it's amazing when you look at the venues, you're in a big range of places, from more kind of out of the West End venues such as Jackson's Lane, but you're at the Barbican, the Shaw Theatre.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, it's very important to us that we started in a very small way in one fringe theatre, the Cockpit Theatre, but for the last, I don't know how many years, we've been in a range of very prestigious central London venues. As you said there's the Barbican, South Bank Centre. We've been for many years at the Royal Opera House in their Linbury Theatre. The reason we're not there this year, very sadly, is because they're being renovated. We used to be at the ICA, which is no longer a theatre. That's a great shame. I shouldn't talk about where we aren't. I should talk about where we are.
But you're at Tate Modern as well. What's happening in Tate Modern?
Well, absolutely fantastic. We had a show, which is now sadly finished, which was a show just for 23 people. It was a piece of tabletop theatre by an artist called David Espinoza, who had this sort of, you know, he has big ideas. You know, he wanted to do a show with 300 actors and elephants and rock bands, helicopters, God knows what else. And he decided, well, he couldn't really do that, but he could do it in miniature. And that's what we did. And it was part of, or it was associated with, an exhibition of works of Alexander Calder, you know, who invented the mobile. And it's very exciting having this partnership with Tate Modern. I think they, you know, they regard it as a big success, and we certainly did. And we hope to continue that in the future.
Tabletop theatre, Andrew.
Tabletop.
You thought it was just a good boozy lunch. I wanted to broaden it out, Joseph, and ask you about, as you said in the introduction, you've directed the Hong Kong Arts Festival, the New Zealand Festival. Yeah. Is there a skill other than organisation to putting these things on? Is it a sense of being an impresario? Is it a great fat Rolodex of contacts? What is there a secret to you being able to do it?
Lots of those things. Yes, it's having lots of contacts. I think in the end, it's having a certain taste.
Yeah.
I think it's, of course, having good taste. Other people might think it's different. But anyway, I think you have to know what works in a particular place. And when people tell you things like humour is international, it isn't, you know. And what works in Hong Kong is very different from what works in Australia or London. And what works in Paris is very different from, you know, all that. So... I've got a big fat address book, and I've got lots of experience. And, you know, over the years with Hong Kong and New Zealand, for example, you know, this involved producing operas and choosing orchestras and all sorts of, you know, it's very different from the Mime Festival. You don't always get it right. But I think, you know, the art is to produce something which hasn't been seen in a particular place before, which will inform and entertain, and which won't make the organisers broke.
If there was one or two things happening over the next few days that you felt that people should definitely make sure they got a ticket for, it, is there something you'd put the spotlight on?
Absolutely. Horror at the Peacock Theatre by a wonderful company from Holland. It's on next Monday and Tuesday. A marvellous show at the Barbican called He Who Falls, Celui Qui Tombe, and also a company from Australia at the Barbican Theatre called Circa, who are doing a sort of circus opera. Big shows, fantastic. You won't see anything like them anywhere else.
Sounds fantastic. Joseph Selig, co-director of the International Mime Festival, based here in London. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, Rob, back on form, I think, in some ways. First of all, Sherpa, an amazing film. I think it's, yeah, it's one of the things people really need to watch. It really kind of makes you in just cross, I think. Just kind of like, it's just one of those rare moments where you realise a filmmaker's presence can do so much to change things and so much to kind of lift the veil on a world. You know, it's not the worst example of, you know, how people get treated in the world, but in a way, it was really interesting, even the debate here, you know, that some of those Sherpas earn, you know, $5,000, you know, for a whole season. Should they earn more? Well, why not? You know, they're the ones that are putting their lives at risk. You know, and when you see in those people's homes, you know, they live in a very simple, basic way. They should be allowed to kind of, you know, decide how much they get paid, and they deserve a bit more respect. So great to see that film, and great to have John in here. I kind of really got riled up about it.
You did indeed, and for good reason. I thought it was an amazing film, though, and a subtle one. My favourite quote in the film was, I think, from a I don't even think he was a shepherd. He was just a man in the village who said, you know, we used to harvest potatoes and eat those in the winter. Why does everyone need to climb up the mountain? And that seems to be the point, because they never used to before. They were asked to by the British, did they? That was the thing.
It's amazing when the Sherpas are looking up at that mountain, they see a deity, and the Westerners just see an opportunity to kind of, you know, get something on their Instagram account. But anyway, that's for another day. But
And let's thank all of our guests. Aisha Malik was fantastic. It's a great novel, that, and she's very good at talking about it. Joseph Selig was particularly cool as well. Yeah, I think he could manage anything, let alone a mind.
Yeah, I think we both thought he'd be quite fun. Maybe he can be another one of our lunches.
I think he was
quite entertaining, I think.
Nice. Let's thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.